recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge high atop the Zarth Arn building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia. It's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and co-host, Phyllis Floyd. Tonight's topic, Maniac. Well, hey, everybody.
Hi,
welcome
Rob.
Back to the old podcast. Hey, Phyllis. Glad you could join us in the lounge tonight. You have to excuse me if I sound a little weird. I'm recovering from a sinus cold, so I'm a little stopped up. I'm probably feeling like I can't talk very well. But we'll do our best to get through this anyway. Tonight, before we get into the topic tonight, coming up next week, we're going to be out of town. We're going to be in beautiful Roanoke, Virginia for the Mysticon convention, which we've never been to before, and here it's a lot of fun. So we're going to be going to that and doing a couple of presentations on Ballyhoo, the Lost Art of Film Promotion, and on doing a panel on Rocky Horror. What do we call it?
From cult movie to mainstream.
So that'll be
very similar
cool.
to the kind of the podcast we did, I guess.
A live version of the podcast we did.
Indeed.
With visual aids.
So if you're near Roanoke on the weekend of February 24th, 25th, and 26th of 2017.
Join us, won't you? So there's that. And coming up March 17th at The Narrow, I'll be hosting another Flick It Fridays, and it's going to be The Warriors, which is going to be awesome.
Can't wait.
So check that out, too. That's about it coming up real soon. So tonight, though, we're talking about the movie Maniac from 1980.
Well, you're talking about the movie Maniac. I haven't actually watched it.
This is a first. We're doing a podcast here where I have seen the movie and Phyllis isn't, so she's going to be my sounding board to bounce stuff off of, I guess, and we'll see how this goes.
Maybe I'll be the voice of, why should I watch this movie, Rob?
You'll be everybody out there that's listening. You might be the only person out there.
That's true.
But this is really a great movie. It's really an underappreciated movie, or you know, you don't hear people talk about it too much. There's a lot of serial killer movies out there, and a lot of them get a lot of play. Like, of course, Psycho is the biggest one, and Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is a more recent one. Yeah, there's a lot of others, but you hardly hear anybody talk about Maniac. And for my money, this is one of the better ones. It's real gritty and has that almost documentary style feel to it, where the city itself is kind of a character in the film. And the camera is almost, in a lot of scenes, is almost like a bystander you're watching. Like,
so
the camera
makes,
is
it makes
you.
The viewer, yeah, right. It you makes know, the viewer you. The,
yeah, you're
camera.
Not just watching a film that's being played out. You're watching, you're like peeking in on what's going on in a lot of the scenes.
Cool.
This actually stars Joe Spinell, who a lot of people don't know his name, but you'll know his face. He's been in a ton of stuff. Usually playing a heavy or Italian mob guy. He was in The Godfather, Godfather 2, and Rocky, and he's done a lot of other stuff too. He was in Star Crash with Caroline Monroe, who's also in this film. We'll talk about it in a bit. And he had a little small part in Forbidden Zone, which is a movie we need to do a podcast episode.
God, we really do, because I'm guessing most people don't know what the heck that is.
Yeah, Spinell's he's a really good actor, and he pulls this off. Because you're used to seeing him play like a heavy mob kind of guy. This, he switches back and forth from a regular guy to when he's talking to himself. You're not sure in a lot of the scenes if he's talking to himself or if he's hearing a voice that's supposed to be like his mother's voice.
Hmm.
You know, or if it's two sides of his personality that are talking to each other. Because it's, I don't know where to start with this movie, really. Because it's really, it's so different from a lot of other movies where they don't do the same thing.
All right, well, I've never seen it, so why don't you tell me kind of what it's about?
It's about a serial killer film.
Okay, gotcha. That's
yeah.
it.
It starts off...
not making me want to watch the movie, Rob.
Okay, it starts off at the very beginning. Well, somebody suggested William Lustig's the director. He went on to do Maniac Cop and a few other things. And mainly, he comes from doing a lot of documentaries for Anchor Bay.
So he likes the word maniac.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he went on to form Blue Underground, which has put out a lot of, released a lot of good movies that might not have seen the light of day, restored or anything like that. So
right.
He's done a lot for that. But this movie, they wanted to make a movie, and Joe Spinell was really behind this. He actually co-wrote it. Somebody suggested to Lustig, Jaws had come out and had been a blockbuster a few years earlier. And they said, why don't you make, Jaws on land? Not realizing they already made Grizzly. But, they actually did a tribute to that at the beginning of this. There's a couple sleeping on the beach.
To Grizzly or to Jaws?
To Jaws.
Oh, to Jaws.
So there's this couple sleeping on the beach. And the killer is, you know, stalking them. The husband goes away to get some firewood, but the way the killer is stalking them is like a point of view, like the shark in Jaws. A lot of times you see the point of view of the shark.
Yeah.
So that's, they kind of a loose tribute to that. And he kills the guy, kills the girl, scalps her, and then he, the next scene, he wakes up screaming in his own bed. So did he really do that, or was that him dreaming of doing that? You don't know at this point. And his apartment is a really small, one-room apartment, claustrophobic, littered with pictures on the walls and mannequins dressed in clothes, and just really a weird, strange... It gives you a feeling of who this guy is right at the get-go, you know? And he's talking to himself in different scenes, and he goes out, and then when he, after he kills somebody, he comes back, and he's talking to himself, and he, you know you shouldn't go out. You know what happens when you go out? Is that him? Is it his conscience? Is it his mother? You don't know.
So are you hearing the conversation as like a voiceover, or is he actually speaking?
Well, see, that's the weird thing. That's the weird thing about
you. You don't see his lips moving?
No. In the first scene, part of the conversation is him talking. Well, not the first scene, but the first time that he's talking to himself.
Right.
Part of the conversation, he is physically talking.
Okay.
The answer to the conversation is a voiceover. It's like it is him.
Huh.
But later on, it's him having both halves of the conversation, talking the whole time. So they never do the same thing twice in this.
I see.
And even with the kills and the camera work, they never do the same thing over and over again. That's what's really cool about it. It was a low-budget movie, and it doesn't look low-budget. Like a lot of low-budget movies do. If you tear it apart, yeah, you can find things and see where the budget, you know, was crimped and all that. But they really did a lot with what they had. The dolly shots where the camera's moving. I was listening to the commentary on this movie. And if you get a chance to see this movie on DVD, definitely watch it. And then go back and watch it with the commentary to get the little inside scoop. Lustig, the director, and Tom Savini, who did the special effects and actually has a part in this, a small part in this, we'll talk about in a minute. And I forget, maybe it was one of the camera guys, cinematographers. They, three guys doing the commentary. It was really interesting. But it's like the dolly shots. They would shoot it, and they, you know, didn't have enough money to pour a lot of track or anything. Right. So they would shoot the scene, and they'd go back and do it again with a wider lens or do a close-up and do it running, you know, going down the same, with the same background, but you never noticed it really because it's, you know, one time it was shooting their feet, one time it was a long shot, one time it was shooting a close-up. So they might have had, I don't know, 20 yards worth of track. They just go back and redo it over and over and over again, but it looked like they were walking at 3 or 4 blocks. It was fantastic.
Creative.
Yeah, and it's done incredibly well. There's another scene where they're going through a cemetery, and it's the same type of thing. They're jumping over the tombstones. They do it from a different angle, change the lens so it's wider angle, and they're using cars for the lights, you know, car headlights.
Huh.
And that you can kind of tell if you think about it, because you can see the hot spots where the lights hit real hot, they're not diffused and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you don't really think about it while you're watching the film, because it's, like I said, it's a good film. I'm surprised that it has gotten overlooked as much. It does have a bit of a cult following, but you never hear people really talk about it. Hopefully they will after this.
Perhaps. Well, I had heard of Maniac, but I thought, well, okay, two things. One, I knew the poster because we've done lots of presentations and stuff on movie or
promotional stuff.
Yeah, I can't talk. So this poster is one that I'm familiar with from those talks.
Oh, yeah, the poster is infamous.
Right, having not seen the movie, but I did know the poster.
Yeah.
But then I did see that they remade this movie. Is it the same plot? Do you know?
Kind of the same plot, the same character name, Frank Zito. From what I understand, they did take some liberties with the story and change some things a little bit, which they would kind of have to. I mean, it was made in 80, which was still the 70s,
right.
You know, as far as movies go. The 80s didn't really take off till like about 82. They have had their own identity, really. You know?
Yeah.
And this was done, the remake was done in 2012, so I need to see it, I guess, to see the differences in it. But
yeah. I was just curious because
it was Wood instead of
Elijah Wood a lot. I was curious because if it's one of those where we always say why remake a good movie? Why don't you remake a bad movie? So in this case, it was actually still a good movie. So
and Joe Spinell is perfect for the part. I can't see Elijah Wood doing this part because Spinell looks like this guy. You know, he looks like he could be this guy, this serial killer guy.
Okay,
and he plays the weak, vulnerable, talking to himself, going, you know, kind of unsure, kind of going crazy character. And then he's But you're used to seeing him playing like a slick back hair mob enforcer type of guy all the time. Mm-hmm. So he pulls it off and it's believable. But getting back to the way this thing is shot, some of the scenes are fantastic. And it has a lot of suspense. I was really surprised going back and watching this again, the things I'd forgotten. A couple of scenes where he's stalking these girls. The first kill, he kills this prostitute. He goes up to a hotel room, and that one's, it's okay. I mean, it's nothing spectacular. You know, it's when it came out, now where he scalps a girl with his razor knife, it's kind of jarring because, you know, we didn't have the Saw and all the super gore. I think the first Friday the 13th movie had just come out not long before this. So that's about where we are in terms of film gore, is the first Friday the 13th. Halloween had come out a couple years before, the first Friday the 13th, and now Maniac. And then one of the other scenes where he's stalking this girl through the subway and into this big restroom area and all, it is shot so well and it's so claustrophobic feeling, especially when she gets into the restroom area and the girl is playing the fear. I'm buying it. You know, she's got that shaking and biting her knuckle, and it's not overdone, but it's realistic. And the camera work in this is amazing. And the suspense that it builds up, he goes and looks for her, and he doesn't find her, and he gets real close, and then he goes away. She doesn't all of a sudden go, oh. It takes her, you know, a little bit to relax and look around, and then finally she starts to relax, and she kind of laughs to herself like, oh my God. But you know something is still going to happen, because the camera's still on her. We're still watching her, so you know something more is going to happen, but you're waiting for it, and it doesn't happen, and then you know when it's going to happen. You know, she's looking in a mirror, and she bends down to wash her face, and when she comes back up, he's behind her again. I mean, it's building suspense, but it's not building it with, it's not cueing you to do it like with music or anything like that. The camera, you watching what's going on, is doing the whole thing. It's hard to explain. You have to see it. But having watched it recently, like, and I watched it with the commentary on, then I watched it again without, so I could sit down and look at it. There's really a lot more going on in this visually than a lot of other serial killer movies I've seen. And I don't watch a lot of serial killer movies, but of the ones I've seen, like I said, this one is really more gritty, and where the camera itself, and I've said this earlier, I'm going to say it again, and the city itself are characters in the film that you don't realize. But I think that makes a more total picture, a more enjoyable experience, at least for me anyway. And the kills, though, you know, it's not over the top. It's not like, you know, you get into your icon pop culture like Freddy and Jason and all that. You know, he has the glove, he has the machete, Texas Chainsaw has the chainsaw. No, this guy has like a razor knife, he has a double barrel shotgun, he has a bayonet. He probably got.
So they're not trying to come up with new and creative ways to kill people.
Nope,
they're just killing
them. Gritty and realistic, I guess. I mean, you know, where do you get a bayonet? Probably Army Navy store. Maybe his dad from the war. You don't know. And there's this great scene where he's putting the double barrel shotgun, he's taking it apart and putting it like in a instrument case. And it just shows the case on the table and the shotgun and a razor knife and a box of Cracker Jacks. And he's taking it apart, he picks up the box of Cracker Jacks and gets a handful of Cracker Jacks, and he goes back to putting this thing in the case. And it's kind of a real moment that didn't have to be there. The Cracker Jacks didn't have to be there, but it just adds a lot more to that you're not thinking about.
Stuff like that always makes me wonder, did the person who was playing the character decide they were hungry and wanted Cracker Jacks and they just happened to be on set?
I don't know.
Put it in there in the script?
But apparently Joe Spinell had a lot to do with this movie, the actor. He co-produced it. He co-wrote it. It was a movie he really believed in and really wanted to make. It comes out later in the film that Frank Zito, the character he's playing, was a victim of child abuse by his mother. And I think he had a really strong belief in getting that kind of message out there about, you know, child abuse is wrong and all that. From what I can gather from interview stuff I've seen. But you don't notice that. Now, that doesn't come out right at first. That comes out later in the film. And speaking of later in the film, I said earlier, Caroline Monroe is in this movie, you know, from the Hammer films. It was in Star Crash with him and, you know, Captain Cronus,
yes.
Vampire, one of my favorite Hammer films. But her character, it's weird because the first third to first half of the film is mainly just him in his apartment going out and stalking these girls, doing the kills. There's no social interaction with his character and anybody else. And then all of a sudden, there is with her character. She's a photographer. She's taking pictures of the park, takes a picture of him. This little kid almost runs into him with a bicycle, and she takes a picture of that. Then he follows her home.
Because she got his picture, or did she just interest him?
Yes.
Okay, just curious.
Yes, because he poses as a painter.
Ah.
He says he's an artist, and he wants to get to know her, and they go out. It's kind of hard to buy that she's showing an interest in this guy, this stranger, who just is an artist and taking an interest in her. And because also, because he's kind of, the way he looks,
mm-hmm.
you know, she is this hot British photographer, and he's this greasy schlub, you know, kind of a little overweight, looks like he could be a hitman, looks like a serial killer. But the character, the movie takes a little weird turn at that point, because, like I said, there's no social interaction between him and hardly anybody else. And then it gets this, and it's almost a different movie. There's another scene where he stalks one of her models. He's at a photography shoot. The model and Caroline, like, hold hands and embrace. And you don't know if, is there something more there? Is it just being friendly? You don't know, is he thinking that too?
Oh, yeah.
You wonder, is he thinking, she's moving in on my girl? Or is it just randomly, that's my next victim? So what he does, he picks up a necklace that she had set down with her stuff so he can take it back to her. Say, hey, I found that you left this at the studio. And he gains access to her apartment. She's getting ready to take a bath. And he hands her the necklace. She opens the door, cracks the door, hands her the necklace. And as she's doing that, with his other hand, he reaches down to, like, put something over the lock. So when she shuts the door, you know, he can get back in. And she goes and takes her bath. Now, this whole scene, even before he's there, the suspense is setting up. And I think this was the first scene they shot in the movie. I might be wrong. But there's little things like one of the doors, the closet door, is slightly ajar. So you're like, is somebody in there? You know, and there's little things like that. The way the camera's moving around the apartment with her, it's like you're waiting for something to happen. And then when it does, it's almost jarring because you're waiting, you're waiting, you're waiting. But it doesn't go over that point.
So it's misleading you to think that it could be he's hiding anywhere, but he just
anywhere.
Comes to the door.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
But then he comes back. But then she shuts the door. And he is supposed to go away. She gets in the bath, gets out of the bath, doing her things. And then he jumps her. And this one's different because this one, he doesn't kill her right away. He ties her to her bed and talks to her. And of course, he's going through all his psycho talking to himself, talking to her, and telling her why he's got to keep her there and all that stuff. And then he ends up killing her and scalping her. I believe he scalps every one of his victims. And it's really weird because he brings the scalps back to his apartment and he nails them to the mannequins, to their heads, takes the wig off and nails the scalp on there. And then dresses the mannequins in the clothes. I guess he takes the clothes from his victims too. But it never shows that he does anything with them sexually. The first shot we see, one of the mannequins is laying in bed, but it's got clothes on. So yeah. Apparently he sleeps with them, but we don't know. Now there is, I think it's this scene that he kills a girl tied to the bed that is, if you watch it and think about it, it is overtly sexual. And as he's stabbing the girl, he's saying, I think he's saying yes, mommy, something, or no, mommy, I can't remember what, but he's saying his mother, you know, mother's name like that.
And this is before you knew anything about its history.
I can't remember this comes in. Exactly. I think later you see more.
I gotcha.
At the end. But this is all part of building up to that. But at this point, he stabs her, and he's laying on top of her as he stabs her, and he's rocking while he's laying on her. Now, does it look like he's having sex with her? Why is he just rocking while he's saying mommy, or is he humping the girl he just killed and saying mommy? So is he having sex with the girl he killed? Is it necrophilia, or is he in his head? Is he having sex with his mom? And while he's rocking, it shows him up, his face is rocking, and then it shows his stomach on her, so you don't see anything but blood coming out from under his stomach on her, you know, this liquid running down.
Right.
So it's kind of, the whole scene is really bizarrely overtly sexual or under current sexual, depending on how you're looking at it, which makes it a lot creepier and grotesque film at this point. Just like the poster, which we didn't talk about. The poster, you've got to see the poster. Of course, I'll post it on the Phantasmo After Dark, the Facebook page, in a folder with his other pictures from the film too. But this poster is notorious for its phallic imagery and just almost over the top, comically pushing it.
Yeah.
In a way where it's just above the waist down, and the guy in one hand is holding a knife, and the knife is wide and not real long, but it's long enough. It's a big knife, and it's following the the line of the bulge in his pants, right in his crotch, mm-hmm. it's following the same line. So it's drawing your eye right to both of those, symbolizing mm-hmm. the sex and the violence and the dominance and the whatever. But in his other hand, he's holding a head. But he's holding the head, the back of the head is facing us. So like the front of the head, he's pulling towards his crotch. But it's not on his crotch. It's beside his leg.
Yeah.
But the whole symbolism of everything that's going on there is creepy as hell. And of course, like I said, overtly sexual.
Yeah. Well, when you
but
see
then
that,
again, when I was younger, I didn't think of it that way.
Well,
I just saw the posters like, oh, it's a knife and it's dripping blood. And the guy's holding a head. It's all, man, it's a, you know, killer.
Yeah, but once that comes to your attention, it's obvious. I mean,
oh yeah, well, the shadow and the highlights on the bulge. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's his junk there. You know? And then that knife right beside it. Draw and yeah, it's really a very effective poster. And yeah. You don't see posters like that anymore. All we got is these floating heads of all the actors that are boring as hell. Hmm. You know, this was a lot of thought went into putting that together. It really did. Now, let's see. After he kills that girl, there's the infamous scene, the shotgun blast scene, somewhere in the film. I can't remember if it's before this or after this. But listed in the credits as Disco Boy and Disco Girl. Coming out of a disco, getting into this car is Tom Savini. And this girl he's picked up at the disco or whatever. And there were still discos in 80. And they drive, they park under this bridge. And they still get in the back seat and start making out. And she sees a face at the car window, she thinks. So he gets back in the front seat because she wants to go home. And they cut the car lights on. And there's Frank Zito, our killer, standing in front of the headlights. And he jumps on the hood of the car and fires a double barrel shotgun right in Disco Boy's face and blows his head apart inside this car.
Oh, wow.
And it's fantastic, the effect. I think Gene Siskel of Siskel and Ebert, his review of this was, when that happened, he walked out of the theater. He said, because the movie, it was so grotesque and over the top, the movie could not redeem itself after that. By today's standards, it's still an incredibly effective gag. One of the reasons they did it is because Savini had a mask or a head of himself from another picture. It was something else he worked on. And so he had that. So it's like, let's use it. Let's blow it up. You know. So they filled it with whatever, all the stuff they had for lunch that day.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And I think they ordered some cow intestines or something, but they were too big. So they put all like the shrimp and everything else they had for lunch inside his head and fake blood. And it's cool, the shot. Now, Savini wanted to pull the trigger himself because they only had one chance to do this. Mm-hmm. Well, one, it's a low-budget movie. They didn't have permits all the time to do filming. And two, it's illegal to discharge a firearm inside New York City. So they had one shot to do this. And what they did is they did the gag, and then everybody jumped into cars and took off.
Oh, God.
And left. They filmed it. We got it. Good. Click. Go.
What? Did they leave the car there full of disgusting things?
No. Somebody else drove that car. The actors went in other cars. And rumor is that they, well, the car, though, it got so, the smell from all the stuff in it and all, that they got rid of it. They trashed it. Savini said they thought they dumped it in the river is what thought they did. But the way the scene is shot, and Savini is in the car, of course, they switch out. They put the mannequin in there. The shot from inside the car, Joe Spinell jumps on the hood. And they get a shot of right before he pulls the trigger. Then Savini, of course, dressed as in the same outfit, is the guy that pulls the trigger.
Hmm.
So he shoots himself in the face with a double barrel shotgun through the windshield of this car. It's fantastic. You got to see it. I mean, I'm sure the clip has been shown. It might be on YouTube. I don't know. But it's great. The head just explodes all over this girl. And then he goes around the side of the car and he shoots her, and it doesn't show that. It just, this is cool because you get the boom in your face, the head exploding, and then he walks around, the girl screaming, it builds suspense, and he points a gun at her, and it shows the double barrels of the shotgun, and he fires, and then it fades to black. It goes to the next scene, so you know he killed her, but we don't see
you it. Don't see that one.
Yeah, she might be the one worse, because at the end of the movie there's a head, you see a headless corpse, so it might be her. I'll get to that in a minute. You know, he has the relationship with Caroline Monroe, and they go out to dinner, and they do this and that and the other thing. That's the weakest part of the movie, are those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're both good actors. The scenes are fine. But from the way the rest of the movie is shot and done, those scenes,
it slows you down.
It kind of, yeah, it's weird. It's a weird part of the movie. And then the last time they go out, though, He picks her up to go. And I think he calls her and says, you want to go to a show or go to dinner first? And he picks her up and he says, do you mind if we go by the cemetery first? I want to drop off a wreath at my mother's grave. I guess it's around Christmas. He does it. She says, sure, no problem. So they go there and they put the wreath down and then he starts talking and he starts crying. And she's like, oh, you know, and he hugging him. It's okay. It's okay. And then he starts choking her. He flips. And of course, the whole time, I mean, his end game, I guess, was to kill her, you know.
Right.
And she breaks away from him. He starts chasing her through the cemetery, and somehow she jumps behind, finds a shovel, picks up, hits him in the arm, cuts his arm open with a shovel, and she takes off running. He gets back over to his mom's grave, and he's crying, and all of a sudden, you get a Carrie moment where the corpse, the hands come up from the dirt and start choking him, and this corpse with maggots in its eyes and all. It looks really cool. It's choking him, and then he's screaming, and all, and then it cuts, and there's nothing there.
Right. That he was just imagined it.
Yeah. He goes back to his apartment. He's laying on his bed, nursing his arm, talking, crying, all this kind of stuff. Look at any the shots around the room with the mannequins dressed and the scalps on them and all this stuff. And then it cuts back to him, and then it cuts to the dinner table, and there's a bunch of mannequins around it. Real quick in your head, they look a little different. Then one of them turns its head, looks at him, and it's his victims.
Mm.
It's all the victims. Mm-hmm. It's not mannequins anymore. And they make their way over to the bed. And they start stabbing him. One cuts his arm off with a machete. They stab him in the gut with a bayonet. And then this is the one I was talking about earlier. This headless corpse comes up from the side of the bed. And it's really creepy. Come to find out, that headless corpse, though, that dummy with mm-hmm. the head, that's the Betsy Palmer dummy from Friday the 13th. Savini said, yeah, he still had it. They just cut her head off, not, you know, a couple weeks ago, whatever.
Right.
So they used
it.
Yeah, so that's Mrs. Voorhees coming to visit Frank Zeno. And the last scene of this, where all the victims are tearing him apart, they pull his head off.
Wow.
And it's done well. They made a life mask, made a fake head of Joe Spinell, and it looks great. And they cut to it quick and back, so you don't see it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks fantastic. And they pull that off, and then it goes to black. The next scene you see is a cop car pulling up, and I guess Carolyn Monroe's character called the cops.
Yeah.
So the next morning, the cops come in, two plainclothes cops. They kick his door open, and they see him lying on the bed, holding a bayonet stuck in his gut.
Ah, he stabbed himself.
So he stabbed himself, yeah. And, of course, it's still the 70s, even though it's 1980,
mm-hmm.
film-wise. And they go, ugh. So they just walk out. I guess they're going to go do whatever they're going to do. They just leave. And, of course, the camera goes around the room, and it goes back to him, and it goes back down right on Spinell's face. And his eyes open.
Of course.
And it goes to black. Like, the end. Or is it?
You
know? There's a lot of other camera techniques used in this. You know, talking about the dolly shots earlier, but they use slow-mo a couple times, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. Just once or twice, maybe. Once that I can recall. The shotgun scene where he jumps on the hood. There's another thing where they use these, I guess they're jump cuts, where it's like a shot, closer, come, you know, click, do, like that.
Mm-hmm.
They do that one time. They don't do it again.
Hmm.
You know, it's a lot of different things they do with the camera that make the film really interesting. And I'd highly recommend anybody, you know, watch this. Get this movie. I guess it's still available on DVD. Might be on Blu-ray. I don't know. I've had a copy for quite a while on DVD. So hopefully it's not too hard to find. If you like serial killer movies, or you just like creepy movies, or, you know, 70s style movies, this is really a great example of all that. And a great example of getting the most out of a low budget and guerrilla filmmaking on the fly. There's some shots they did where Joe Spinell and like the cameraman went out and did a lot of second unit filming after everybody else was done for the day. Everybody else went to bed, went to sleep, and they go out after midnight and go out on 42nd Street and just filming him, like looking in store windows, you know, looking at mannequins and stuff, and this montage of shots. And it's fantastic. It really adds a lot to his character and the feel of the film. Stuff that wasn't really in the script to do. They just, hey, let's go do some stuff. Let's get some more of this guy's psyche. And it works really, really well. You know, I can't say enough good things about this film as far as for the type of film it is. Is it one of my favorite all-time films? No, it's not. Definitely not one of my favorite all-time films. But for the type of film it is, it's one of the best, in my mind. One of the best of this genre. A couple other interesting things about it. There's a couple of porn stars in it from the day. Abigail Clayton and Sharon Mitchell play, I think. I want to know Sharon Mitchell plays a nurse. Mm-hmm. Just small bit parts. to keep costs down. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't hire SAG act because it wasn't a SAG film.
Mm-hmm.
And they had such a low budget. So, you know, they hired some port actors to fill in some little bit parts. And the helicopter shots. They couldn't afford a helicopter. But there's some helicopter shots of over the city that they used when Lustig was working on. The director was working on Inferno. He was not the director, not producer, but worked on the film. And so he got some footage they didn't use, extra footage they didn't use of these sweeping helicopter shots he used in this.
Oh, that's cool.
And some of the pickup shots they had to do. Now, Joe Spinell was real good friends with Stallone. Matter of fact, he helped him get Rocky made. And he believed in Stallone, helped him get it made. So, and then Stallone put him in it, then put him in some other films, like the movie Nighthawks, mm-hmm. that Stallone did with Billy Dee, who did with Lando.
Mm-hmm.
And they were filming Nighthawks right after this. And Spinell cut his hair shorter and shaved his mustache to play. I think he was a police captain or something like that in Nighthawks. I don't remember. But they had to do some pickup shots for Maniac before it came out. So in some of the scenes where he's driving in his car by himself, and I think one or two where he's with Caroline, they had to put a fake mustache on him, and he's wearing a wig for his long hair. So the mustache looks a little different, mm-hmm. but it's not really enough. If you don't know that, you're not really going to notice it.
Right.
But now that you know it, you're going to look for it. Yeah. So they went back into stuff like that. But I don't think Spinell, I don't know if he even took a salary for this. I know he put money into it to get it made.
Wow.
But he really believed in the story of the film and wanted to make this movie.
Hmm.
And apparently when they showed it at Cannes, it got rave reviews and was packed every night that they showed it, from what I hear in the commentary.
Right.
I'm surprised that it hasn't got a bigger following or you hear people talk about it as much. I mean, you hear people talk about the movie Hillary Portrait of a Serial Killer, which I haven't seen yet. I guess I need to see, talking about it so much in this. And of course, Psycho is like the gold standard, mm-hmm. you know. But this, I don't know. I keep saying I'd put this right up there in the top five, top three serial killer movies, because it's more of a, you're right there watching what's going on. You're not watching a movie about a serial killer, mm-hmm. you know. Another interesting thing, they were filming one of the scenes where the prostitute filmed in this hotel. And I can't remember the name of the hotel right now. It's a well-known hotel in New York somewhere. In that same hotel, while they were filming, somebody did kill a girl.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I guess it was a serial killer. I don't know. I don't think they ever caught the guy.
Well, that's freaky.
Yeah. So they were questioning them too, you know, about that. They had a permit for that night, though.
Good thing.
Yeah. I'll definitely on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page put up the trailer and as many pictures as I can for this. I wish we could show this at Phantasmo or somewhere, but unfortunately it's an Anchor Bay film, so we don't have the rights. Yeah, maybe we could do something with the Narrow sometime. I don't know. We'll see. Well worth the watch, though, if you're into this type of movie. I guess that's about it. I don't know if I have anything else to really say about it.
Well, I'm intrigued. I may have to watch it at some point.
Well, you know, we watch it tonight if you want. I'll watch it again. It's like I said, for the way it's shot, it's a great film to study.
Right.
If you want to make movies. Mm-hmm. Or if you're interested in the way that movies are made.
Right.
The things that they did with the low budget and the way the camera, I think because it's such a low budget, they had to do more interesting things with the camera to get as much bang for their buck. Whereas if they had a bigger budget, it might not have been as good a film.
Yeah.
I don't think. Or at least not as interesting a film.
Right.
You know, hey, as I always say, judge for yourself. Watch this movie. Get it. Maniac, 1980, William Lustig director, Joe Spinell is a star. Caroline Monroe, Tom Savini with his original nose. He says in the commentary, he's like, oh, that's my old nose. He had a little bump taken out, so he has a straighter nose now. But look for it. If it's available, maybe I'll look that up and post that on there, too. But that's about it. You got anything else to add?
Just one thing.
Yes.
How does Caroline Monroe relate to Planet of the Apes?
I forgot. We got, okay. Our regular segment here, our new feature on Phantasmo After Dark is...
It's not new anymore.
No, it's not new, but our regular end of the show feature now is I can connect anything back to Planet of the Apes, 7 degrees, more or less, give or take. Clayton and I started doing this many years before 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon. So
I think it's 6 degrees, but whatever.
6 degrees, whatever the hell it is, I don't care. Planet of the Apes is the world revolves around Planet of the Apes.
Indeed.
And we'll prove it at the end of each episode. So you want to have Caroline Monroe.
Yes.
Can explain names. Oh, God, it's going to be so easy.
Well, they're all easy to you, it feels like.
Caroline Monroe to Star Crash, to Christopher Plummer in Star Crash, to Star Trek Undiscovered Country. If you go to Star Trek, you go directly to Planet Apes, because Mark Leonard was Sarak in Star Trek, and he was also General Urko in the Planet Apes TV series.
Well, there you go.
Done!
That was too easy.
Drop mic.
Don't
actually,
drop
you know, if you've ever bought a microphone before, anybody that's ever bought a microphone before would never drop a microphone. So it's really kind of a dumb say. Because they're not cheap. Anyway, there you go. That's how the world revolves around Planet Apes. So,
well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And that's all. We'll see you next time. And thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.
Good night.